listening to Money on the Left, the official podcast of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, or MMNHD for short. I'm Billy Soss. Along with Scott Ferguson, I'm co-director of MMNHD, which is a big tent organization for scholars, social critics, and political activists dedicated to recovering and redeeming the cultural and political aspects of modern money, past and present. Follow us on social media at Money on the Left, and catch videos from our recent international conference on our YouTube and Vimeo channels. In this episode, Scott and Max are joined by Fadl Kaboob, Associate Professor of Economics at Denison University and President of the Benzhagar Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. Fadl's research builds on MMT to shed new light on the political economics of post-colonial and developing nations. As he makes clear in his chat with Max and Scott, regaining financial sovereignty is a crucial next step for post-colonial nations hoping to achieve social, economic, and environmental justice. They talk specifically and at length about the CFA franc currency union, a system with violent colonial roots that continues to constrain the economic and political agency of its member states in West and Central Africa. Thanks as always to Alex Williams for producing the episode and to Hillbilly Motobike for the theme music. Side note, for this conversation, I was out on assignment in Washington, D.C. to catch the Poor People's Campaign rally on the National Mall. I managed to record some sounds while I was there, and we hope to share those with y'all soon.
Fadl Kaboob, welcome to Money on the Left.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I was wondering if we could start by having you tell us about your personal background and also your intellectual training.
So personal background, I grew up in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, in Tunisia. I did most of my education, higher education, in Tunisia and moved to the U.S. for grad school, went to University of Missouri in Kansas City, did my master's and PhD there. The timing is relevant here. I started in January 2000, which was about 6 months after the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability was inaugurated in Kansas City at UMKC. This was the research center that was directed by Matt Forstatter, with the research team including Randy Ray, Stephanie Kelton, Pavlina Cherneva. And then later on that year, Fred Lee joined the economics department, and it was just becoming a hub of post-Keynesian and institutional economics. It was just a wonderful place to be at in terms of grad school, summer programs, and just intellectual development. After my PhD, I went into teaching, actually even before finishing my dissertation, a little bit in Kansas City, obviously at UMKC, which was a great experience, but then eventually started teaching full-time tenure track at Drew University in New Jersey, and then moved back here to Denison University in 2008 on a tenure track, and have been here since then, almost 10 years now. And about 4 years ago, Matt Forstatter and myself had the opportunity to launch the Benzhagar Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, which is a public policy think tank, an independent think tank based here in the U.S., but from the beginning we wanted to make sure that it's an international organization in terms of our coverage. We wanted it to be not your traditional academic think tank that publishes papers primarily for academics. We wanted this to be solutions-oriented and accessible to the media, accessible to grassroots organizations, and accessible to policymakers. So we still do publish academic papers, but we're trying our best to move into policymaking and policy communication with the general public and with the media and with grassroots organizations. And we also, from the beginning, wanted this not to be purely an economic policy institute. We wanted this to be an interdisciplinary organization, because we do recognize that the biggest problems that we face as a society are complex, multifaceted issues and require multi-pronged solutions. And economics by itself just doesn't have enough breadth and capacity to deal with these issues. So we wanted, for example, when you think about climate change, I mean, there's obviously an economic dimension to it. There's a political dimension. There's an ethical dimension. There's a scientific dimension to it. So you can't just, you know, try to address it from an economic policy standpoint and expect, you know, good results. So we wanted this to be an interdisciplinary institute, but also we wanted to have, you know, a solid foundation for what the focus of this institute would be. And because of, you know, our background in post-Keynesian institutional economics and our interest in MMT and the Job Guarantee Program, that was clearly going to be one of the central issues that we deal with, because we do believe this is a policy framework that kind of challenges the mainstream of public policy, the mainstream of the profession, to rethink how we address social and economic problems. But also we wanted this to be an invitation to our friends in the environmental movements and social justice movements who are progressive on every single aspect of their work, except they fall in the trap of, you know, if we're going to, you know, deal with climate change, how are we going to pay for it? And that's where they fall into the traditional economic policy framework that says, well, we need to tax the rich to do it, or tax pollution to do it, or, you know, the government is broken, we don't have resources, so we can't be as ambitious in our fight against climate change, or fight against injustice, or fight against whatever social issue is. So we wanted to connect with progressives in other disciplines and build bridges that allow other disciplines to be honestly be liberated and empowered by what the MMT and Job Guarantee Framework has to offer. So that's really the vision. And the last 4 years, we've been building those bridges with people in the humanities, people in legal scholars, philosophers, and political scientists, and people from all kinds of different disciplines. And it's just the beginning. This is a long process, obviously, of undoing a lot of the damage that has been done in the economics discipline and academia in general, but especially in public policy. And I get this question all the time, like, are you going really to undo the neoliberal, you know, political economy with this institute? And the idea is yes, but also it's a recognition that we're a few decades late and several hundred million dollars behind. We're outnumbered and understaffed when it comes to this, but that's what it takes. It takes building a compelling narrative based on solid academic research and engaging with people at the public policy level, at the grassroots level, because I truly believe that the way the neoliberal movement was able to dominate starting in the 70s and 80s, it's not because they won academic debates in journals or in, you know, conferences. It's because they were able to put together a narrative, a political narrative that was compelling, that, you know, hit a nerve when it comes to the U.S. public at the time, in the 70s especially, in the U.S. and the U.K. also. And, I mean, the Friedmans and Hayeks, they lost all the academic debates, but they won the political narrative. And they had charismatic leaders who, you know, took it to the streets, so to speak. And they had multi-million dollar type of foundations behind them to push for the media and PR movement and kind of shift the culture. And I believe that's how we're going to counter this. It's not going to be just academics, you know, sending rejoinders to each other's papers. we've done that, and it's just going to stay in those circles. I think this has to be taken to the public domain. If we're going to build a movement, a social movement, it has to be accessible to the general public, and it takes a lot of education, and it takes a lot of really engage citizens who are looking for alternative and willing to learn the alternative. And by learn, I don't mean in the academic sense. Learn meaning, you know, in the colloquial sense of the term, that you'll be able to say what you believe in and articulate how it can work in non-academic terms, and get other people who are completely disconnected from, say, the political sphere to be inspired and to believe in a different way of doing things and to vote accordingly and to act accordingly. That's really the vision that we have, and recognizing it's ambitious, but we're really seeing bits and pieces of this happening. So I'm optimistic.
I actually have a follow-up question, which takes us back to the beginning. I'd like to hear, if you don't mind,
yes,
a little bit more about growing up in the Middle East, in Tunisia and Saudi Arabia, and what your own process of politicization mm-hmm. has been, and maybe when and where, and what that might bring to the Modern Money project, that's different, right, than what we get from other perspectives within that project.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for the question. I've been reflecting on this for a few years now in terms of how my own thinking has been influenced by my upbringing. So, as I said, I grew up in Saudi Arabia and Tunisia. My mother's side of the family are from Saudi Arabia. And my father's side of the family is from North Africa, Tunisia, and to some extent Algeria. So thinking back on that experience, I really didn't grow up with the very powerful, overwhelming sense of national identity. I knew it was there because I can see it in my cousins on both sides of, of the family, like very, you know, the flag and the national anthem and the love for the football team and all that. I mean, I love the football teams, but when they, I like both, and I like Brazil, and I like Argentina, I like other things. But there's this thing that I noticed from the beginning that, my goodness, people are crazy about the flag. but I never understood what it was. I just thought, well, this is their team and they like it, and it's, you know, crazy football fans, you know. But you know, growing up later, you realize that this was designed. When you think about all the post-colonial states in Africa and the Middle East and other places, governments didn't really have much of a legitimacy. It had to be earned. It had to be created. In the case of Tunisia, for example, yes, there was the national leader, the independence leader, who was a very charismatic person but it didn't really. There were no national borders, pre-colonial national borders that were well defined, and that we're going back to those borders. So, the border had to be created and confirmed and protected, and then the national identity in terms of language and religion and culture, because a lot of these places were pretty diverse, ethnically diverse. So national identity was, in most post-colonial countries, was created and enforced through music, through culture, through sports, and with the you know, the idea of what you would call here in the U.S. patriotism, and other countries called nationalism. There's that negative connotation about nationalism, but it's, to me, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I grew up not feeling kind of sucked into that understanding of national identity. For me, it was, you know, this is a country, this is another country, and I like both.
Why is that?
I never grew up with a sense that I will die for my country, because which country will you die for? Plus, I come from a country that's from a family that's also very international. So it wasn't like everybody on one side of the family was Saudi and everybody on the other side of the family was Tunisian. We had, you know, through intermarriage, people from Egypt and Palestine and Algeria and Morocco and Lebanon. So it wasn't like we had only one or two national identities that the family had to pledge allegiance to. So it's an unusual family to begin with. So to me, that sort of came back to me later, you know, later in my career, reflecting on this and starting to really think about what national identity means and how powerful it can be in war and peace conflict in terms of dividing nations. So I take comfort in knowing that I experienced that at an early age and sort of began to reflect on it throughout my life, and now I understand how powerful those ideas can be. And I can understand when I hear or see, you know, people who feel very, very strongly about a flag or their military or the nation, because I know it's nothing personal. It's just you're born into it and you're brainwashed into it. And to some extent, there is nothing wrong with that. The only part is when it comes to it's us against them. And it begins to divide people because of the difference of their religion or their color and things like that. So it's you know, a healthy dose of patriotism is reasonable. I'm not against that. Loving a football team is great, and loving the national anthem is great. But when it turns you against other people, it becomes problematic.
It's really interesting. When you talk about your experience of you know, growing up in post-colonial Tunisia and Saudi Arabia and experiencing nationalism, and there's a kind of what makes me think of is the way that post-colonial theorists tend to, you know, they begin from the presumption that you've already alluded to, that even though relations of explicit political colonization seem to end during the 19th and 20th centuries, that largely there are unjust processes of economic, sociocultural colonization that remain strong. And they sort of frame this and focus on history in the politics of money and foreign denominated debt. And I was wondering if we can kind of now circle that experience back to MMT, and if you could help elucidate how MMT can imagine reframing this critical project, you know, in terms of political economy, and then perhaps even a socio-cultural critique that you already started to tease out.
Right. So let me take this back to my undergraduate studies in Tunisia. I studied economics in Tunisia, and it's a French post-colonial education system. So it's not liberal arts. There is no general education. It's 4 years of economics and nothing but economics and, you know, a little bit of accounting and business and lots of math. So there isn't really anything political economy per se. The closest we got to political economy was the history of economic thought class, which was the best thing I've ever taken. It was a breath of fresh air in those 4 years. But to link it back to your question, the reason why I wanted to go back to this is because those 4 years of economics that I studied in Tunisia, we didn't learn anything about the Tunisian economy. And this is not because it was neoclassical economics, and neoclassical economics didn't teach you anything about the real world. No, it wasn't the case, actually. We had great teachers who are sort of post-Keynesian-ish, institutionalist, kind of French circuitist influence, which was great. But this was strictly political. I learned so much about the Japanese economy, so much about the American economy, so much about the French economy. But, you know, the students, we went to a couple of the professors after class, say, can we just have like one lecture about the Tunisian economy or economic history? And we did take an economic history class, but it was about the Great Depression and the U.S. and Japan and everything else. And the professor will say, leave me alone. What do you guys want? Go away. And it's because they didn't want to get into anything that will cross into politics. Because there were undercover, you know, police officers in the classrooms and on campus listening in, because, you know, the history of protest in Tunisia was, you know, either the labor movement or the student movement or both converging together. So that was when you were going to police the population, you police the universities first. So the campus where I studied was not like American campuses. It was a gated campus and guarded by the riot police. Actually, the riot police had one of their headquarters on campus, full gear. And those were the visible guys. So the invisible ones were in the classroom. So that's why the professors didn't even dare to talk about anything that has anything to do with the Tunisian economy. So what I ended up learning about the Tunisian economy, I learned it in Kansas City after I left. I mean, what I knew about the Tunisian economy was just observing and living in it and just trying to piece things together on your own or with a few friends who, you know, people you trust to talk about political economy with at the time. But what I ended up learning academically, intellectually, was just after I moved to the U.S., I just, you know, started diving into books and archives and whatever I can find through interlibrary loans to read everything that there was to read about the Tunisian economy. I ended up doing my dissertation on Tunisia. So there's an important link to your question here about the post-colonial thing. And there's an intellectual movement actually in the last few years, both in Tunisia and other parts of Africa in particular, trying to essentially decolonize the curriculum. Because the curriculum itself, in any discipline, was a Eurocentric curriculum. I mean, this is true in the U.S. too, but it's especially in the Middle East, because when you think of the history of any intellectual discipline, economics, for example, you read the economic, you know, history of economic thought textbooks, the classic ones, or even the newer ones do a little bit better, but not much. So if you read Schumpeter, for example, his book was the classic history of thought. He talks about the great gap, because first there was the Greeks and then the Romans, and then there was nothing for 500 years. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Enlightenment happens. And you read the history of science books, same thing. There was the Greeks and the Romans, and then there was nothing, and then all of a sudden science emerged in Europe. So that's taught in every single textbook, including in the Middle East and Latin America and India and Africa. That's how the Eurocentric narrative dominates and ends up colonizing the curriculum of supposedly post-colonial independent nations. So you're already put into an intellectual position of inferiority, an economic position of inferiority, and a political position of inferiority, of subordination. But you have your own flag, and you have your own national anthem, and you have your football team to celebrate. Yeah, you see what I mean? And that happens to serve also the interest of the political leadership, because in most post-colonial nations, the political leadership didn't really democratize the nation. They took over the exact same top-down bureaucratic hierarchy, which was a dictatorial hierarchy created by the colonizers. It's just now staffed by nationals who love the flag. You see what I mean? So it was still a political and bureaucratic institutional structure of subordination, but now led by, you know, the charismatic independence movement leader, now turning into a dictator. So I hope this answers your question in some sense. But that's how I read it for several years now, in terms of reflecting back on and talking to academics today in Tunisia and former professors who sort of understand that this is really the part of the narrative. In addition to the fact that, you know, the linguistic domination has been there from the beginning and constantly enforced by the colonial interests. So Tunisia is an Arab country. But the main language of instruction academically is French. And that over time came at the expense of losing the linguistic quality of the Arabic language in professional settings, in academic settings. And that's, you know, when you lose a language, it's really hard to undo that.
I'd like to pick up on your point about the kind of organizational legacy of colonialism and subordination and sort of ask, you know, in adopting the colonial governance scheme that was imposed on nations in the global South, these countries, for, you know, for large part to do with the intergovernmental organizations that made sure of this, kept this idea that they still depended upon the United States or France or countries across the globe from the global North for loans and debt so that they could finance their militaries and their often corrupt dictatorships. And I was wondering if you could talk specifically about the way in which MMT reframes that discussion around foreign debt and sort of monetary sovereignty.
Right. So for the followers or the listeners of the podcast who are not very familiar with the MMT framework, I'll just define the four basic bullet points that will be relevant to this conversation. So from an MMT perspective, a country has full monetary sovereignty or full financial sovereignty, in colloquial sense, you know, full financial independence, if the following four conditions apply. And the first two conditions are pretty straightforward and easy for any country to do. This, the third and fourth are more problematic for post-colonial and developing countries in general. So the first condition is a country prints its own currency, issues its own currency, and it's the monopoly issuer of that currency. So most post-colonial governments, the first thing they do, not the first thing, but a couple years after independence usually, is they start issuing a national currency. And they start taxing the population in the national currency. That's the first and second condition of monetary sovereignty. And most countries can do that. The third condition is for a country to issue debt or issue bonds or treasuries that are only denominated in the national currency. And that's where a lot of developing countries start to lose their monetary sovereignty, because they start issuing both categories, bonds that are denominated in the national currency, but also bonds that are denominated in U.S. dollars or Japanese yen or British pounds or any kind of foreign currency. And that part of their bond issuance becomes their external debt. And it's a real burden on those governments, because it's not something that they can finance internally. It means that you have to somehow generate export revenues in excess of what you would need to pay for your imports in order to be able to pay the debt, service the debt, and pay principal and interest. And that relates to the fourth condition, which is the fixed exchange rate policy that a lot of developing countries use. So in order to have full monetary sovereignty, you want a flexible exchange rate. In other words, you don't want to stand ready with excess reserves of dollars or euros or pounds to defend a particular exchange rate. And that, because of the third condition that's often violated, meaning if countries have a lot of external debt and have a lot of pressure on their exchange rate to devalue, that becomes politically and socially a very sensitive issue, because if a small country faces a devaluation of their currency and they need to be importing food or fuel or energy or medicine or whatever necessities, it means with a devalued currency, all of those things now will cost more. And they'll be importing inflation, food inflation, energy inflation, medical expenses inflation, and that turns into social unrest in many cases. So that's why a lot of these developing countries end up borrowing even more every year in order to defend a fixed exchange rate level, which would prevent that inflationary pressure from actually turning into political and social unrest. So to me, that's a very important starting point, and that's really the important lens that MMT has offered us to see with clarity why the issue of debt is problematic. Because before the MMT lens, people knew that debt was an issue, but there was a confusion or conflation of the national as in domestic currency denominated debt versus external debt denominated in foreign currencies. And I think MMT tells us that it's the portion of the debt that's denominated in the national currency can always be managed, and there are ways of dealing with it. But the external portion is what really puts pressure on countries. And that's, personally, that's what led me into researching the root causes of the external debt and looking into potential solutions to address those root causes. Because everything else we've seen in the last 30, 40 years is really band-aid solutions. It's really just rescheduling, stretching out the debt payments, or getting more external debt and kind of feeding into the same problem that's just been compounding over the years.
So can you walk us through what it might look like for a country that is heavily indebted, has a weak productive infrastructure, is not, as you say, sovereign in food and or energy? What might be done in a situation as dire as that?
Right. Well, first I'll tell you what is being done and how things got worse, starting with the post-colonial era, and then we can talk about how to get out of it. So going back to the colonial and early post-colonial era, you have to recognize that the economic infrastructure of most of these countries was built up because colonialism lasted for decades, a couple of centuries in some cases. So during that time, there was infrastructure built, and there was a process of economic development and economic activity happening, which a lot of people confuse with economic development in the purest sense of the term. But when you look carefully at what kind of infrastructure and what kind of economic development was done, you realize that it was very extractive. Any kind of infrastructure that was built was purely for the purpose of extraction of wealth and extraction of resources. For example, Tunisia is a very interesting case, and you can look at the map of most African countries and post-colonial countries, and just look at the map of the roads, and then identify where the major mines are, where the major resources are, and where the ports are built. And it's just direct straight lines from the mining town straight through the rest of the country to the ports. And the railroads are built like that. The roads are built like that. So Tunisia, for example, you find a lot of east-west roads and east-west railroads, but nothing going north-south because there's no reason for people to go north-south. And so once you're independent as a country, you're not going to sit down with the rest of the population and say, okay, so this was a big mess, this colonialism. Let's now start over again and let's scrap all of the infrastructure and build it the way we really want it to be built. It wasn't like that. Day one after independence, you continue doing the exact same thing you did before independence. So you continue digging the same mines, loading on the same railroads to the same ports and shipping them to the same customers in France or in Italy and other places. So the post-colonial economic infrastructure continued to be built according to the colonial economic infrastructure. It was a continuation of it. It wasn't a rupture from the old economic system. And it continued to enrich the same socioeconomic classes and the same vested interests to this day. So it was always extractive, always serving the elite, always serving the interest of the former colonial interests. So the question today is, you look at the accumulation of trade deficits and external debt was because we were told, well, your economy is mostly extraction of resources and agriculture. You should diversify and you should invest in manufacturing and industrialize, right? So you try to industrialize and there's a huge technological gap. So what do? You go through an early phase of import substitution industrialization in the 1950s and 60s, basically. Most developing countries did that. And under protectionism, protection from foreign competition. But then 10 years later, you're told that's it. Your infant industry is not infant anymore. So now you should move into export-led growth. Good luck exporting. So when you move into export-led growth in the 1970s, one of the first things you notice with every single country that went through this phase is that the trade deficit explodes. You would think like we were going into an export-oriented mode. We should be thriving through exports. And it turns out you end up importing even more. because if your economy is not highly industrialized, you end up importing all the intermediate goods and all the technology and all the input that goes into your assembly line, you know, basic manufacturing system. So you're importing high value added content and you're exporting low value added content. You're just adding the, you know, kind of very basic assembly line skills to export a finished product. So if you're importing more than what you're exporting, your trade deficit is exploding. How do you finance this trade deficit? Because now it's putting pressure on your exchange rate, and it's going to turn into food riots and, you know, fuel riots and all kinds of instability. You borrow, and that's where the external debt comes in. And, you know, you borrow based on the idea that will you grow even faster in the next decade and you'll be able to pay it off. And it just never happens because you're never industrialized enough to compete internationally. So this whole era of opening up to free trade and globalization has been a massive trap for developing countries that actually led to even more loss of financial sovereignty over time than directly after independence. So the way to undo this or to sort of regain or reclaim monetary sovereignty is to look at the specific cases. I mean, there's no cookie cutter approach to this. So every country has its own institutional specificities and needs. So you look at what is causing the external debt, what is really driving it. Is it food imports? Is it energy imports? Typically, it's both for most countries, with the exception of oil exporting countries. And the third category is typically what I described as low value added content of exports relative to the high value added content of your imports. So if you're going to reclaim your food sovereignty so you don't have to borrow as much to buy food from abroad, then the only way out is investment in sustainable agricultural policy, domestic agricultural policy. I mean, this is something that the West recognized from the beginning. This is not something that I discovered or people discovered the last few years. If you go back to the free trade negotiations, the GATT and other trade negotiations in the 50s and 60s and 70s, to this day, the West will always negotiate and they say free trade in everything but arms and farms. So no weapons and no food, because that's national security for the West. And it's not just national security because you need food during wartime. It's because you lose your sovereignty. You lose part of your sovereignty if you're dependent on other countries for your national security, for your food security. And this is really, I mean, I've known this for a long time, but MMT really put a new light on this particular issue. So you find the European Union and the United States putting really impossible conditions in these trade negotiations, making it impossible for developing countries to export food. Because in the case of Europe, a lot of the former colonizers, were dependent on food imports from North Africa and other parts of the world. And that wasn't going to be fun, you know, economically speaking, after independence, because now you depend on these newly independent nations for your food supply. So CAP, which is the Common Agricultural Policy that the EU put in place, was essentially virtually a ban on food imports and also a massive subsidy for European farmers to build up capacity and depend less and less on imported food. So that ends up killing agriculture in a lot of developing countries. And when you kill agriculture in developing countries, you're forcing people to move out of rural areas into urban areas, which was pretty convenient because the, you know, cheap labor for manufacturing assembly line jobs was waiting for them, because that was the era of export-led growth. And that becomes, you know, developing countries become the tail end of the supply chain in the global supply chain system, because they're just the assembly line for all the, you know, high value added content that's been produced through the rest of the supply chain. And it happens to be convenient because it creates a little bit of jobs in developing countries, but never enough to truly industrialize those countries or truly develop those countries or bring prosperity. So I hope this clarifies the links between especially Europe and former colonies in Africa.
It does. Can you talk about some of the dangers and potential inflationary pressures? I know in your own work you stress a strong political movement, but also sometimes a very careful and strategic economic development approach.
Yeah. So the strategic economic development approach to reclaim monetary sovereignty is renewable energy production, because that's another major component of the external debt, sustainable food policy, and then because that's the food imports problem that many developing countries have. And then the third one, which is more difficult of a strategy and takes a long time, is investment in education and vocational training and technical skills. Because if you want to industrialize and over time move up the ladder, so to speak, and the value-added content, the only way you're going to attract manufacturing that produces higher value-added content is if you have the infrastructure in terms of electricity and telecommunication and transportation, but also the highly qualified labor that's required to be plugged into the production of high value-added content. And that takes time. It takes a couple of generations to move up the ladder. So those are the three strategies that I always emphasize. And the question is, well, can we make the transition overnight or in a decade? To me, the answer is not. It's not going to happen overnight or in a couple of years. But at least you have to start thinking about that direction, planning for that direction, and then shifting resources away from your old strategy into your new strategy. Because the current strategy, for example, is to subsidize food and food imports and to subsidize energy imports, because you're importing fossil fuels at globally determined prices, which can be inflated for your local consumers. And if you don't subsidize them, you're going to have fuel riots. If you don't subsidize imported food, you're going to have food riots. So governments typically subsidize and offer food and fuel and transportation at affordable prices locally. The idea here is to shift some of the subsidies away from subsidizing fossil fuel and imported food into building more productive capacity of renewable energy production and sustainable food production. And over time, accelerate that shift and accelerate the development of those resources, because that's the ultimate way of reclaiming energy sovereignty and food sovereignty, and as a result, monetary sovereignty.
And as a result, political sovereignty.
Absolutely, because you become less dependent financially on the outside world, and as a result, you're more politically independent. And to be honest, I mean, that's been recognized from the beginning by former colonizers as a threat. I mean, it was clear that having this neo-colonial way of controlling former colonies through the financial aspect is way more effective than having troops on the ground controlling the economy and policing the population. Because it gives you the illusion of political independence, and you have your flag, and you have your football team, and you have your territory, your military, and we'll even give you aid to help you reinforce your territorial sovereignty and police your population and everything. So it feels like, yeah, we have independence. But when it comes to economic reality, you're not independent. And as a result, politically, you're constantly under manipulation by the lenders and typically countries who were the former colonizers. So that's really the part that the average person doesn't necessarily realize. But political elites know this, and they know that they can use it to their advantage, because they're not really, in most cases, they're not really willing to take on the challenge of challenging the external forces. Because in many cases, especially when it's not a democratic system, they're actually kept in power with the help of external forces. This was definitely the case with the Ben Ali regime. It wasn't it wasn't you know, a secret or anything. It's if anything, you know, during the days of the uprisings in 2010, 2011, the French Minister of Interior was vacationing in Tunisia with the president's family and called France to request more to approve more shipments of tear gas for the police to handle the protesters. And the only reason why the tear gas didn't make it to Tunisia because workers at the airport were on strike in France. It had nothing to do with the political agreement between Tunisia and France. It was just a coincidence that workers were on strike. And you know, when you travel through Paris and workers on strike, you don't get your luggage. So the tear gas never made it.
So I think something that's been in the news that is really evocative of what you're describing is the question of currency unions.
Yes.
And the way they determine political and economic relations. However, a lot of attention has been paid to the Eurozone crisis and in Greece and Italy and Spain and the political unrest that is kind of resulting from that. I was wondering, though, if we could talk about a currency union, if you want to call it that, that it gets a lot less attention, the CFA franc, and if you could tell us about the history of it and the structure of the CFA franc today.
Yes. So the CFA franc is a currency used in Africa. Today it's used by 14 countries, mostly former colonies of France. And the name of the currency union changed over time, just to make the name more politically correct, I guess. So CFA used to stand for trying to remember the French name. It's Colonie Française d'Afrique, which means the African colonies of France. That's what CFA used to stand for. So it was clearly, you know, these are the colonies and they use the French franc, but this is the African version of the French franc. It's controlled by the French government, by the French authorities. And then after independence, you can't call these, you know, colonies anymore. So it, at some point it changed its name from Colonie Française d'Afrique to Communauté Française d'Afrique, which was a little bit more politically correct. And today it's called Communauté Financière Africaine, which is the African financial community or union, if you want to call it that way. So it doesn't carry the colonial name anymore, but it still operates under the exact same institutional setting, which is a currency union that for 14 countries today. It was created in 1945, right when a lot of the former French colonies were gaining independence, but they were not transitioning to a national currency. Most colonies, the few years after independence, they continued to use the same colonial currency. But in the case of the West African and Central African countries, the 14 countries that remain in that union today, they transitioned into the CFA franc, Franc CFA. And so when you think of monetary policy and fiscal policy and exchange rate policy, it's all determined by the French government, essentially. I mean, there's a committee and there's a board and there's, you know, some sort of bureaucratic structure to it that's staffed by representatives from the African nations, and presumably they get to make their own decisions and vote. But we all know that it's nonsense, that it's set up by the French government. I mean, Macron has been under fire in the last couple of years, especially during his visits to Africa, because there's lots of protests against it, and the students, you know, brought it up during the open Q&A session. And he keeps brushing it off and saying, well, nobody, I'm not standing in the way of any country to leave the CFA if they want it, or we don't control it. It's if anything, he sees it as a way of cooperation and assistance and help to stabilize the monetary system of the 14 countries in the union. But in terms of our experience knowing what monetary sovereignty means from an MMT perspective, you clearly understand that, you know, a group of countries that use a single currency that follows a particular set of monetary policy rules has a very limited fiscal space to engage in strategic economic development internally. I mean, everybody's familiar with this situation in Greece and Italy and Spain after the euro crisis, when you have a central bank like the ECB that refuses to allow any of the member countries to deal with the economic crisis and imposes austerity on those countries. You can think of the CFA franc system as exactly the same setting. It's 14 countries joined in a monetary union. They have no way of issuing their own currency, and they peg their currency to the euro today. It used to be to the French franc, which was pegged to the dollar indirectly via the gold standard at the time. You can understand how much economic development has been withheld and how much economic sovereignty has been withheld from these countries. And unfortunately, it took decades for this beginning of a movement to start building in the last few years. And I think MMT has a lot to contribute in this regard, and I'm looking forward to working with some of our new MMT-ish friends in this movement to build a coherent narrative, a coherent counter argument to the CFA, and to bring about an alternative. And I don't think this is going to be done through the political elites. I think it has to be done through a social movement. I don't really believe in, you know, political leaders, quote unquote. The political leaders are not leaders; they're really followers when it comes to these things. So it has to be a social movement that builds a coherent narrative, a coherent critique, and a coherent alternative. And when you get to a critical mass of people, of media, of academics who engage in a coherent way, that's when political leaders, you know, really take action and honestly become followers when it comes to this.
Yo, hein, c'est la clameur de la rue, un cri trop longtemps réprimé des opprimés que t'as entendu. Éternel assisté, nos présidents sont vos valets. Crachons cette pilule des indépendances que nos pères ont avalé. Souveraineté illusoire, économie sous perfusion. Comment peut-on prétendre être libre avec la monnaie du colon? Cet homme noir qui ne serait pas assez rentré dans l'histoire a décidé de se réinventer et d'être maître de son histoire.
Do you have a sense of the way that the Eurozone currency project compounds the problems of the CFA franc?
Well, yeah, if you're economically dependent on France and the Eurozone for your economic well-being, and the main unit, the Eurozone, is going through a crisis, you suffer the consequences. So there's a direct link to this. And it's ironically, this is really what woke up a lot of people to the reality of the connection between CFA and Europe. But it was ironic because it wasn't really in the MMT way, because a lot of people were saying, well, the gold reserves of the CFA countries are in France, and the French are probably using that to deal with their economic crisis. But it did raise awareness about the issue. But obviously, to you and me, understanding MMT is really not about the gold. But for a lot of people in these countries, they say, well, we're the largest producers of gold in the world. Where is our gold? It's held in France. And why is our economy not doing so well? But it's not because the gold is in France. It's because your economy is producing raw materials, and raw materials are very low value-added content, and you don't get to control the price of those raw materials in the global system. So no matter how much you produce of your raw materials, if you're the number one exporter of this particular commodity, you're still not going to be reaping the benefits of it. And you can think of this in terms of African countries or North African countries. I know this specifically for Tunisia because Tunisia is one of the largest producers of olives in the world. Depending on the season, it's number three, number four, sometimes number two. But it doesn't get any of the publicity of being an olive oil country. I mean, when you think of olive oil, it's Italy, it's Spain, because these are the distributed brands that you pick up in the supermarket, or Greece maybe, or Turkey, because they've done a better job at controlling the global supply chain and branding their product. And most of the money is actually, most of the price that you pay is for the bottle. It's not for the olive oil. And for the PR that goes with it, with the advertising that goes with it. So it turns out that for the average Tunisian farmer that's producing the olives, they end up selling their entire year's worth of olives, their harvest, a year in advance at a set price determined by an Italian company or a Spanish company. And when you look at how much of the market Spain and Italy collectively control, they essentially have, last time I checked, 4 or 5 years worth of global supply of olive oil in reserve. So if you're a small farmer and you don't want to sell at a set price, they say, keep it. Good luck. You know, good luck selling it, because we have enough to supply the entire world for the next 5 years. So as a farmer, you can't, no matter how big you are, you can't afford to negotiate. And this is true for all kinds of farmers in Africa. So when you think of, you know, chocolates, you know, what's the main input? Where does it come from? It doesn't come from Switzerland. It comes from African farmers who don't get to control the supply chain. They don't get to control the price. So they're at the lowest end of the supply chain in terms of value-added content. And who gets the most of the benefits? It's the companies that add that value-added content, which is the pretty bottle or the, you know, fancy designs or the, you know, the nice chocolate boxes or whatever that most customers in the West pay most of the price for, that not for the actual raw material. So this is a structural economic development problem in the CFA region in particular, and yet the recognition of the economic problem came through the crisis in Europe and the thought that the gold was in France and that's why, you know, things are messed up. But it's beginning a conversation with colleagues and activists and journalists about what MMT has to offer about this. And we're shifting the narrative to the real structural problems, not just the fact that gold is stored in France.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about these global issues and you know, the story you just described about the olive oil, it makes me wonder if there is any, you know, if we're going to reimagine what development looks like, you know, in a global economy, is there any role for an intergovernmental authority like the United Nations to play in the process of further decolonization?
Yeah. And this is, and there was several attempts to do this over the years. And you can guess, it's not the IMF and it's not the World Bank. Good guess. which are technically agencies of the UN. They just happen to be the, you know, more politically and financially powerful organization of the UN. But within the UN, the organization that has done the most in this regard is UNCTAD, which is the UN Conference on Trade and Development. And especially, and I'm probably biased here a little bit, especially when Jan Kriegel was in charge of writing the UNCTAD annual reports and organizing the UNCTAD conferences. Jan Kriegel is one of the leading post-Keynesian economists, one of the most brilliant economists, period. But also his work with the UN and his understanding of Keynes and MMT and the global financial system led him into what I just described, basically. I mean, a lot of the things that I've learned about economics and MMT, I've learned from Jan Kriegel, obviously. So you hear a lot of his thoughts in me, and anything that's a bunch of nonsense, it's probably me thinking, not his thinking. but he and other economists at UNCTAD have probably done the most to rally developing countries to think differently and to act differently. But if you ask Jan Kregel, I'm not going to speak for him here or put words in his mouth, you'll hear a lot of stories about how much pressure UNCTAD as an organization gets, political pressure, gets from the West, from the U.S. in particular, how much pressure representatives of developing countries who really begin to, you know, learn from the UNCTAD approach and attempt to act accordingly, how much pressure they come under. Because you have to realize that the process of international development is not done in isolation from geopolitics. So you're at the UN and you're negotiating, economic development issues with other governments who also happen to be negotiating all kinds of other things with you, and all kinds of other things with other allies that have nothing to do with you, but somehow your vote in the Security Council matters on a particular issue. So you get a lot of pressure for, you know, if you attempt to align yourself with the other developing countries who happen to align themselves with, I don't know, Cuba, for example, then you're with them, not with us, and you'll suffer the consequences. You have to remember that you're doing this in the context of massive external debt. You're dealing with all kinds of problems, including maybe a potential civil war, including potential rebels, including potential unrest because of food prices going up. So you're extremely vulnerable to pressures from the West if you attempt to, you know, gradually, you know, pull yourself out of the, you know, the dominant structure that you're suffering from, because it takes time to build an economic development strategy and put it in place. And that time, you need some sort of immunity from all kinds of other threats and interferences and pressures. And that's the reality of it. There is no such thing. So that's why a lot of economists and people are thinking about the geopolitics of this. When the Cold War ended, it made this even more difficult, because for developing countries at the time, they could sort of fall in between the East and West and kind of leverage and play a little bit of the geopolitics, you know, between the Soviets and the Americans to get a little bit from both. But now that we live in a world that's exclusively dominated by U.S. interests and U.S. power geopolitically, there is no negotiation. There is no running away from that kind of influence. So then the only way out of this is to start building sort of south-south regional cooperation, economic development units. And it's very difficult politically and economically, because you have to agree on a joint strategy. And, you know, to get a number of countries to agree on a particular strategy is very, very difficult. But also to get a group of countries that have complementary assets and resources to coordinate is difficult. At some point, there was a little bit of hope that BRICS will emerge as that alternative, a geopolitical alternative. BRICS as in Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The S was added eventually as South Africa, as an alternative to the U.S. geopolitical dominance. But I don't know how likely that is going to actually emerge, because BRICS itself as an organization has been divided over the last few years. So in the absence of a block of countries that have geopolitical influence that can offer an economic alternative, it's very hard for developing countries to shift strategy. There is the possibility that, you know, the Chinese model of economic development and China's interest in the rest of the world, economically speaking at least, may offer a little bit of relief, but you also have to take that with a grain of salt, because China also has its own economic and geopolitical interest that it's trying to build up to being a superpower, a true superpower. So you have to take anything that comes from the Chinese government also with a grain of salt, or fistful of salt, I should say.
So you've done some consulting work with various governments and groups in what we call the Global South. I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about those experiences, what you've learned, and yeah, just general lessons from that work?
Yeah, so just to clarify, when you say consulting, I don't have any official affiliation or paid positions with any government in the Global South. By consulting, I mean people reach out and want to, you know, ask questions and, you know, have long conversations or presentations. So yes, I've done that, but not as a paid consultant for any government.
Understood.
So the most of the interest is really what we described today in this podcast, which is we recognize that everything we've tried has failed. You know, all the, you know, stages of economic development that every textbook follows, including the most recent waves of privatizing state-owned enterprises, you know, leaning heavily on tourism, foreign direct investment, export-led growth. So the MMT lens and the sort of UNCTAD economic development analytical lens allows us to recognize that those are traps, because the more you accelerate your exports, the more you end up with imports of intermediate goods. So you're never going to catch up. And the more you privatize state-owned companies to pay, you know, to generate dollars to pay some of your external debt, once you privatize the water company, you can't reprivatize it the next year again. It's just a one-off, and then you lose that asset, and then you run out of assets to privatize. And then, of course, you lose control over strategic resources in your own country. The idea of foreign direct investment is also a trap for most countries, because you realize most foreign direct investment actually goes to rich countries, not to poor countries, because it's going after, you know, it's looking for strong infrastructure, water, electricity, transportation, telecommunication, and most developing countries don't have that. And it's also, foreign direct investment is looking for skilled workers, highly qualified workers. Most of those happen to be in Canada and the Netherlands and other places, not in the poorest countries. So this idea that foreign direct investment is going to solve all the development and poverty problems is a myth, because we use China and India as examples of great places that attract foreign direct investment, but those are not your usual developing countries, because they have massive infrastructure of telecommunication, transportation, everything else. And they have invested massively in producing the labor force that FDI, you know, higher end FDI is looking for. So you look at most other developing countries, it's really assembly line jobs, the tail end of the supply chain at the lowest skill levels, the lowest value added levels. So that's not going to work. So that's the context within which a lot of sort of progressive voices within those governments or really eclectic and not necessarily progressive, just eclectic and pragmatic individuals try to reach out for alternative ideas. So we start having conversations like the one I just have with you, and then we get into the geopolitical stuff. And then that's when they realize this is going to be a problem, because this is not just a technical solution. This is a political economy framework that has to be undone. And it starts with a lot of education. It starts with, you know, leading into a social movement. And this is really where, you know, having these conversations with colleagues in Mexico and in Colombia and other places, and they say, we don't really have what you guys have, for example, in the U.S., which is kind of the beginning of a movement, like the groups like Real Progressives and others who, you know, all kinds of people from all kinds of walks of life, not academics, not professors, you know, people who are work 9-to-5 jobs, but who are very passionate about public policy, who now understand the issue and can argue and offer a counter narrative and can stand in front of a senator or representative and say, you can't trick me into this because I know better. And I can argue back, and I can even educate you on what the solutions might be. So we're at the beginning phase of building sort of a popular movement of people who can actually argue back against the senator or representative. And they say, we don't really have that yet. and we don't have that kind of social movement. We have a few academics and a few activists, but it's not a movement yet. So a lot of the conversation eventually shifts into working on multiple fronts. So beginning a conversation with academics, which is the most difficult one to get, you know, academic economists to think differently. Working with progressive policymakers who are not necessarily dogmatically wedded to, you know, neoliberal ideas or neoclassical ideas, to start to show the potential, and working on social media and working with popular media to popularize the ideas in the public domain, and engage with the usual suspects, with labor unions, with activists, with climate justice activists and social justice activists, to say, look, we're allies on this thing. We have a solution. And this is a solution that empowers your organization and your message to build a united front against neoliberalism. So this is how you build a movement. And as I said earlier, politicians are the last people to follow, because you talk to them behind closed doors and they understand. And then they say, well, that makes sense, but I can't say this publicly because I get attacked by all kinds of media and other political parties that say, you don't know anything about inflation. You want to turn us into Zimbabwe or whatever. And if you're the only one trying to counter that, it's difficult. So they say, you know, get me a critical mass of people who endorse this, and in other words, get me a social movement, and I'll come out and embrace it. And I always joke, I say, well, you know, if I have a social movement, we'll vote you out of office. we don't need you. And that's the reality. But we can't give up. You, as I said, you have to work on multiple fronts. Work with policymakers who are, you know, willing. I mean, we're not saying that everybody has to come out and say, I'm an MMT, you know, candidate, and I endorse this and that and the other. Just start shifting the narrative and make common sense decisions in parliaments. So when you're being asked to look at foreign direct investment options, just be more selective. Go for the higher value-added content. Try to negotiate a little bit better. When it comes to, you know, dedicating resources to, you know, subsidizing fossil fuels versus, you know, renewable energy, domestic renewable energy infrastructure, make the right decision. Move away from fossil fuels, no matter what the pressures are, and think of strategies of building energy sovereignty and food sovereignty. And you don't have to say this is MMT. You don't have to say this is inspired by UNCTAD or anybody. This is just common sense. So that's where, you know, policymakers can be more effective, just by making common sense decisions that fit into the broader strategy that I described. But again, we have to work on multiple fronts, and that's why we were really fortunate to have the opportunity to create the Benzaga Institute, because we didn't want this to be stuck in academic circles, because we've done that for a long time, and as I said, we don't think that's how the world is going to change. It's not going to change in academic journals that you know, publish rejoinders. I like rejoinders, but you know, they're not going to change the world.
Indeed. Well, this has been incredibly informative and engaging. Fadl, thank you so much for joining us on Money on the Left.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Our money should be gold, said Mr. Gaddafi. We don't want no CFR. You know, that's not our currency. So, all the gold from our mouth.